Talk show. My next feature needed to take sharper aim. The Duchess of Windsor had a pillow embroidered with the motto, "You can never be too rich or too thin." I wanted to debunk this claim by profiling wealthy women who were both. Kurt liked the concept, but was skeptical that women would discuss their weight with a reporter. I thought these women would leap at the chance to brag about their willpower. My hunch proved correct. The last time I weighed myself, I was under 115, but I was wearing a big fur coat and shoes at the time. Nan Kempner, a well-connected socialite, told me over the phone. Once she spoke on the record, others followed. The story's lead featured wordplay out of my sports writing past. In New York, there is an inverse relationship between a woman's dress size and the size of her apartment. A size 2 gets a 14-room apartment. A size 14 gets a 2-room apartment. Susan Morrison, longtime editor of The New Yorker, edited the article and made it edgier. Art director Alexander Isley designed an eye-catching layout with insets of these women's bony necks and twig arms. The New York Post's Page 6 picked up the March 1986 piece with a banner headline, "Flat Facts About the Slim and Solvent." Syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman riffed on my observation. Years later, in his book Snark, critic David Denby praised Too Rich and Too Thin as a lovely piece of juvenile. At least, I think it was praise. I'd never heard the word juvenile, but lovely sounded positive. Spy quickly grew into a cultural phenomenon thanks to the genius of Kurt and Graydon. Kurt kicked off each issue with a beautifully crafted essay that wove together politics and pop culture to reveal the zeitgeist. Kurt was also the first person I ever heard use the word zeitgeist. I so admired Kurt's distinctive voice that for years I tried to copy it, totally missing the point. Graydon was an equally gifted writer whose outward charm masked his scathing prose, especially when the magazine was mocking a certain short-fingered vulgarian. Kurt and Graydon deployed me as an all-purpose reporter. I contributed to every section of the magazine, short pieces for the front, centerfold maps, and charts and sidebars for cover stories like Colleges of the Dumb Rich, Wall Street Crooks, and Little Men. I believe part of my success as a reporter was that I sounded young. I'm still convinced that the elusive Edwin Schlossberg, husband of Caroline Kennedy, took my call and gave me a quote because his assistant thought I was working for a high school newspaper and he wanted to be nice. As Spy became more popular, it also became harder to get interviews on the record. In the early days, people would pick up their phones and speak freely. After a year, potential targets had become more guarded. I was growing frustrated when my home phone rang in March 1987. "Please hold for Tina Brown," a voice said. The British editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair jumped on the line. She said hello, then got straight to the point. "I've seen your work in Spy. Come work for me." Tina made a great pitch, dangling an enticing offer of 40 grand a year, which was more money than I ever thought I'd make. Spy had started me on a salary of $100 a week, and to make extra cash, I babysat for Graydon's kids. Actually, the babysitting was cool. I had no social life at the time, and his kids were terrific. For many reasons, the decision to leap to Vanity Fair was easy, although telling Graydon that I was leaving Spy was hard. At least, he was gracious. "You're making the biggest mistake of your life," he warned me. About 5 years later, Graydon became Vanity Fair's editor-in-chief. We had a good laugh about that in his swanky new office. My early contributions for Tina were short, quirky pieces that she dubbed Nell Things. Slowly, I was starting to develop my own style, mostly high concept with a visual component. The Vanity Fair issue featuring a nude, pregnant Demi Moore on the cover included a Nell thing entitled Tropical Art. That piece asked noted art collectors, if you were stuck on a desert island, what three paintings would you bring along? Madonna, Jackie Mason, Brooke Astor, David Sally, Mort Janklow, and Robertson Davies all played along, which is the 80s in a nutshell. At 27, I no longer felt like an aimless failure. I had built a nice career. I had built a bit of confidence. I had built a happy life. Then one Sunday, while running errands, I bumped into Spy copy editor Joanne Gruber. It was great to see her and catch up. Then, at the end of our conversation, she paused to weigh her words. "Nell," she said hesitantly, "I don't mean this as an insult, but I think you could write for TV." An air horn went off in my head. Chapter 3. The Setup. Dialogue from my spec script for It's Gary Shandling's Show. Ruth: "I thought you might need an extra pair of hands." Gary: "That would double my sex life." Trying something new should be the easiest thing in the world. If you succeed, great. And if you fail, you have the perfect excuse. Hey, I've never done this before. I decided to take Joanne's advice and give TV writing a shot. All my knowledge of TV writers came from watching The Dick Van Dyke Show. Rob Petrie, Buddy Sorrell, and Sally Rogers had a lot of fun writing for character Alan Brady, played by Carl Reiner. Still, their workplace seemed about as realistic as the astronaut program on I Dream of Jeannie. Nothing in my upbringing pointed toward a career in TV. Geographically, Boston and Hollywood are about as far apart as you can get in the continental United States. Philosophically, they're even further. Several local boys managed to make the leap. Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, and Mark Wahlberg have become three of our biggest movie stars and two of our finest actors. But growing up in Newton, it was hard to find even a tenuous connection to show business. Leonard Nimoy's parents lived in the same elderly Jewish housing complex as my maternal grandparents. Granny, Frances, said the Star Trek star visited one day, and I almost lost my mind. The next time I was in the building's lobby, I inhaled deeply, thrilled to be breathing the same air as Mr. Spock. 40 years later, I met Leonard at a book party for Lynn Povich's memoir, The Good Girls Revolt. We bonded over our ancestors' shared address and then chatted about art. When I mentioned I was co-executive producer of Warehouse 13 on the Sci-Fi Channel, Leonard cocked an eyebrow. "Really? And how did you become interested in science fiction?" "I was drawn to it at an early age," I said. "You don't choose it. It chooses you." "That's a good point," he said. "It certainly chose me." Then Leonard roared with laughter. While I voraciously consumed movies, TV, and plays growing up, I had a limited view of the entertainment industry. Performing seemed like the only way in, and by the age of 12, I'd peaked. During the summers in the late 60s, I was cast in three musicals at the Barn Playhouse in New London, New Hampshire. My roles included Tevye's youngest daughter, Bielka, Snow Child No. 3 in Carousel, and Princess Ying Yawalak in The King and I. Yeah, I was a white kid playing an Asian girl long before Emma Stone was even born. The actress playing Anna in The King and I was married to the Barn's musical director, Stephen Schwartz. He went on to become the award-winning composer-lyricist of Godspell, Pippin, and Wicked. I went on to sit in the audience of Godspell, Pippin, and Wicked. Writing as a way into TV had never occurred to me. When my spy editor raised the possibility, she pointed out a door that I'd been walking by every day, but had never thought to try the handle. If real estate's mantra is location, 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 showbiz's mantra is talent, talent, talent. No, wait, that's what it should be. Instead, it's connections, connections, connections. While I'd been too scared to comp for the Lampoon in college, I knew a former editor who had moved to L.A. to work on HBO's Not Necessarily the News. The old boy network came through for me. Rob Lezebnik offered to send some of my spy pieces to his very young, very aggressive agent, Gavin Pallone. Rob's kindness paid off when I introduced him to my younger novel-writing sister, Claire. At first, she made fun of Rob's funny last name, and then 2 years later took it as her own in front of friends, family, and a judge. Rob found me my first agent, and I found him his first wife. I've since switched agents many, many times. Rob and Claire are still going strong. Gavin signed me based on my magazine work. He explained that the standard way to break into television was to write a spec, short for speculative, script for an existing series. He would pass along my writing sample to studio executives and showrunners to try to get me placed on a staff. Around this same time, I ran into SNL writers Tom Gammel and Max Pross, who had been friendly with my sister Alice in college. Tom offered me a tip.
Hey, you should go see Albert Brooks's movie Real Life. It's playing in the Village this weekend. I think you'd really like it.
Real Life changed my life. This 1979 fake documentary follows a family on camera in a parody of the first reality show, An American Family. Albert Brooks plays Albert Brooks, the filmmaker, who keeps inserting himself into the story. He breaks into song, he frets about gaining weight, he manages to be simultaneously insecure and smug. While Groucho, Woody Allen, and Mel Brooks winked at the camera, Albert played his part straight. He said hilarious things but never acknowledged them. I became a complete convert after this two-line exchange in Real Life where Mrs. Yeager, the mom, becomes rattled after the cameras follow her into the gynecologist's office.
"I want to be alone," Mrs. Yeager says.
"Okay," responds Albert. "Can we come with you?" I walked out of the film, tingling. Albert's tone was both absurd and grounded. His sense of humor inspired me. I wanted to write that way, too. For my spec script, I should have turned to one of the popular shows of the time, The Cosby Show, Family Ties, The Golden Girls, Cheers. Instead, I decided to write an episode of the sitcom that made me laugh the hardest. It's Gary Shandling's show. Like Real Life, its premise was absurdly self-referential. Gary played Gary, who lived in a condo with three walls, facing an audience whom he addressed directly, which is why it's called Breaking the Fourth Wall. This cult classic is not as well-known or well-regarded as Gary's second series, The Larry Sanders Show, but I'm one of the weirdos who enjoyed it more. My agent Gavin represented a writing team at Shandling, Al Jean and Mike Reese, and they forwarded some produced scripts for me to analyze. Once I understood the structure, I worked out a story bouncing ideas off Alex Isley, who I knew from Spy. Alex pitched jokes back and showed me early on that a friend who provides vocal encouragement is great, but a friend who provides actual help is even better. When you're writing a spec, the rules are unclear. Do you have to think of every plot point yourself? Write every line? Is it fair for friends to give you feedback? Add jokes? With rare exceptions, comedy writers get help. In Steve Martin's memoir, Born Standing Up, he tells a story about his first joke that ever aired on TV. It has been proven that more Americans watch television than any other appliance. Hilarious, right? And so Steve Martin. Except Martin admits that he didn't write it. The joke sprang from the mind of his then-roommate, comedian Gary Mule Deer. With Mule Deer's permission, Martin pitched the line at the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and people loved it. Martin further admits that two colleagues pointedly asked him if he'd written the joke, and Martin said he took full credit, adding that if he'd been hooked up to a lie-detecting machine, it would have spewed smoke. It's wonderful that Martin included this confession because no one would ever question his comedy chops. But even he got help from a friend. Obviously, the majority of a spec script had better come from your brain because if hired, you'll have to deliver. Still,
TV is a collaborative medium, and learning how to receive input from others and separate good ideas from bad is a big part of the job. In a couple of weeks, I'd pounded out a complete spec script. It's Gary Shandling's show, often featured cameos of stars, and I copied that format. I wrote a scene set in the kitchen where Gary and his pudgy friend Leonard are exchanging diet tips. Leonard: I have a photo of Dom DeLuise on my refrigerator door. It discourages me from digging into the chocolate chip too often. Gary Shandling: That old trick. I've got something even better. Gary opens the refrigerator door to reveal Dom DeLuise sitting in the refrigerator, reading a book and eating a piece of pizza. Dom extends the slice toward Gary. Dom DeLuise: You hungry? Gary Shandling: No, I just lost my appetite. I even added a callback. During a party scene, Gary returns to the kitchen and opens the refrigerator. The rotund actor is still there as Gary grabs a bottle of champagne. Dom DeLuise: What's that? Gary: It's Perignon. Dom? My agent sent the spec to his clients, Al and Mike, and asked for feedback. A couple of days later, Gavin called, and I heard my first happy agent hello. Al and Mike had liked the script enough that they gave it to Shandling's showrunner and co-creator, Alan Zweibel. Alan had called Gavin to say that the show wanted to buy my script. They'd even fly me to L.A. so that Alan and Gary could give me notes for a rewrite. I started jumping up and down like a rookie who'd hit a home run in his first at-bat. Literally and figuratively, I was on my way to Hollywood. A week later, I nervously walked into the Shandling offices at Sunset Gower Studios. I stopped by Al and Mike's office to thank them for their help. We talked about the business, and they offered me three invaluable pieces of advice. 1. Never be afraid to write on spec. 2. Don't ask friends for work. 3. Take any job that comes your way. You never know where it might lead. The first piece of advice is pure gold. There are so many reasons to write on spec. Sometimes you get an idea that's weird and you know it won't sell on a pitch, so you have no choice but to write it on spec. Sometimes you get an idea that you love, but you don't want to endure the painfully slow pitch process, so you write it on spec. And sometimes you want to try a new genre, and the best way to experiment is to write on spec. I become a better writer every time I finish a script, so it never feels like a waste of time. Over the years, I've completed 7 full-length movies on spec, sold 2, 1 was produced, and I'm still holding out hope for the rest. Al and Mike put me at ease before Alan's assistant summoned me to his office. We made small talk while we waited for Gary. I'd seen all of Gary's stand-up specials, which gave me a sense of what to expect. A brilliant, perceptive, and neurotic star. 10 minutes later, Gary hustled by the room wearing sunglasses. He doubled back and regarded me quizzically. Alan introduced us and reminded him that I'd written the script they'd bought. Gary nodded approvingly. You write like a guy, he said. I beamed. One of my favorite comics had just paid me a compliment. It was only in the rental car later that his warm words gave me a slight chill. I knew Gary meant the comment as praise, but by bringing up my gender, it also carried a hint of negation. Had I sold out other women by smiling when he said that I wrote like a guy? I tried to think of what would have been a better response. I replayed the moment in my head and came up with these mots d'escalier. You write like a guy, Gary says in the do-over. Oh, I say with a dismissive wave, that's just something I did in the snow once. Etching your name into a snowbank with pee seemed like the only writing where men truly do have a clear advantage over women. I wasn't fast enough to think of this retort at the time, and I still cherished Gary's praise. For many years after, if I was struggling at a job, I'd remind myself, Gary Shandling thinks I'm funny, and it boosted my spirits. Gary joined us in Alan's office and sat on the couch just long enough to declare that he wasn't in the mood to give notes. He apologized and asked if it would be okay if we discussed the script some other time. I was returning to New York the next day, so I glanced at Alan, who came to the rescue. He said they could give me notes over the phone. Gary approved the plan, then said he was heading to the set. "You want a tour?" he asked. It was my first time ever on a sitcom set. My brain tried to make sense of what I'd seen on TV and now stood inside. Everything looked smaller thanks to the sky-high stage ceilings. I was mesmerized by Gary's living room, his couch, his Mercedes golf cart. I noticed a ping-pong table off to the side. Gary explained that they were shooting an episode that parodied the Robert Redford movie, The Natural, substituting baseball with ping-pong. I laughed. As we passed the table, I lingered. "Do you play?" Gary asked. "We had a table in our garage growing up, and my brother and I used to play after dinner most nights," I answered. "Want a hit?" "Sure," I said, picking up a paddle. "You know I'm good," Gary said as he moved to the other side of the table. It was a statement of fact, not a brag. He was simply letting me know what to expect. We started to volley. I kept up. When I slammed a forehand past Gary, he cocked his head. "Let's play a game." We did, and I surprised him. Oh, I didn't win, but I did make it into double digits. We placed our paddles down. Gary shook my hand and thanked me for coming in. I returned to New York. When I walked into my studio apartment, there was already a message from Alan on my answering machine. He and Gary had talked some more and decided not to move forward with my spec script. Instead, they had a new story idea for me to write. If I called him tomorrow, he'd fill me in. This was disappointing. What I thought was a home run had turned out to be a long, foul fly. But I was still at the plate. The next day, I called Alan, who pitched me my new assignment in two words. Haunted condo. I laughed out loud. The premise was bare bones. An old tenant in the complex named Lydia Cavanaugh dies, and her ghost won't vacate her apartment, which upsets the condo association. I expanded the story and wrote a new script in a week. It went faster than the first, and at least one joke has withstood the test of time. Grant, there are some who say Lydia Cavanaugh was a witch. Gary, there are some who say Geraldo is a journalist. To get a script from New York to L.A. in the 80s required military precision. Gavin would arrange for someone in the agency's New York City mailroom to pick up a manila envelope left outside my apartment door. The envelope would be pouched across the country overnight, and then someone in the agency's L.A. mailroom would drive it to the studio the next day. Hitting send is so much easier. A couple of days after I turned in the new draft, Gavin called and I heard my first sad agent hello. It's the oldest story in the book. Girl gets script. Girl loses script. Girl gets another script. Girl loses that one, too. Alan told Gavin that although they weren't going to shoot the haunted condo episode, they would pay me a full script fee of $11,000. That took some of the sting away. In 2 weeks, I made the same as 3 months of journalism. I hung up the phone and tried to sort out my feelings. I'd been so excited, then so disappointed, and now those feelings were canceling each other out. This left me feeling numb. Over the past 30 years, I've felt numb a lot. I learned not to get too happy about good news or too distraught about bad. It's not just me. I once called my friend Chris Kaiser after his pilot script got picked up to production. "Congratulations," I said. "Thanks," he replied cheerfully. "Just another step on the path to inevitable disappointment." Being realistic about the odds doesn't mean you don't care about a project. It means you acknowledge that others control what happens to that project. One friend who has a shelf of Emmys summed it up. Be as happy as you can be, for as long as it lasts, but sustained joy is not part of the deal. In this sense, my Shandling experience was the perfect way to lose my TV virginity. The highs and lows set realistic expectations, and the inevitable disappointment was offset by so many rewards. I made money. I got to play ping pong with one of my comedy idols. And to prove Alan Mike correct, that you never know where a job might lead, I ended up working with them again on several projects, including The Simpsons and their own outstanding animated show, The Critic. Writing that first spec proved the spy editor had been right. I could write for TV. More importantly, I'd enjoyed the scriptwriting process. It's always better to like doing something than to be instantly good at it. If you're successful but hate the process, you'll stop doing it. If you suck but the work intrigues you, you'll keep at it and get better. 5 months after my Shandling adventure, I got hired on a new Fox late-night show. It was the fall of 1986, and I moved to L.A. and rented an apartment with my sister Claire in the Fairfax section of West Hollywood. The Wilton North Report, named after cross streets, combined comedy with journalism and opened each night with a weekend update-style look at the news. A crew of correspondents taped reports and conducted in-studio interviews. This format had a lot of overlap with The Daily Show, which premiered 10 years later and had the advantage of digital technology, only a half hour to fill, and a charismatic host. After passing on Ellen DeGeneres, the executive producer settled on two bland male hosts who came from morning radio. In the week leading up to the Wilton North premiere, we held mock run-throughs. I wrote a spy-ish piece where I made snarky comments about magazine ads. For example, I held up model actress Kelly LeBrock's famous "Don't Hate Me Because I'm Beautiful" ad and said, "No, Kelly, we don't hate you because you're beautiful. We hate you because you can't act." The crew laughed, and later that day, the executive producer called me into his office and asked if I'd do the same bit on the premiere in 2 days. I was stunned. The last time I'd performed was as Amaryllis in a high school production of The Music Man. "Were you there?" I killed. If I agreed, I'd have to perform live on national TV on a night that would be reviewed by every newspaper in the country. It was an insane request, and I gave an insane answer. Yes. I would never have volunteered for the mission, but when called, I served. There was a lot of chaos and little rehearsal time. As a lifelong nail-biter, I was hugely concerned about holding up the ads and the camera picking up on my nervous habit. I shouldn't have worried. My hands were shaking so much that you barely noticed the chewed-up nails. I got through the piece quickly, maybe a little too quickly. Most of the reviews ignored my short segment and focused on the hosts. The San Francisco Chronicle was an exception. They included this as one of the show's highlights. "A cute commentary on sex and advertising by Wilton North writer Nell Scovell, whose funny smile and clear wit were enhanced by her undisguisable nervousness." Not to nitpick, but you really don't need the word undisguisable in that sentence. I did one more on-camera segment for Wilton North where I interviewed a Pee Wee Herman doll. My hands shook less, but I still wasn't bitten by the camera bug. I saw the way Conan O'Brien, who was also writing on the show, relished his time on camera and how much he added to the material. For me, it made more sense to write for Conan, like a New Year's Eve 1988 bit where I had Conan pucker up close to the camera so that anyone home alone could get a smooch. In early January, there were rumblings that Wilton North would be canceled. Conan, Greg Daniels, and I spent hours in our offices trying to divine whether we'd have jobs in a month. At one point, Conan grabbed a marker and said, "Here's how the executives will decide our futures." He drew a caricature of himself flipping a coin. We lost that coin toss. The Wilton North report was gone 2 weeks later. Both my first and second TV jobs ended in utter failure.
But as every sports writer knows, third time's the charm.
Chapter 4, The Big Twist.
A man steps into an elevator and sees a beautiful woman inside. As the doors close, he turns to her and says, "Excuse me, can I smell your pussy?" She recoils in disgust. "You most certainly cannot."
"Oh," he says, "then it must be your feet."
Joke Told to Me by Eddie Gorodetsky. I love this joke. It starts with a sense of menace, then pivots to stinky feet. Even babies laugh at stinky feet. When I'm directing, this is one of my go-to jokes to tell the crew to break the ice. It's short, a little shocking, and ultimately harmless. It lets crew members, who are still mostly male, know they can swear around me. Also, for the rest of the shoot, prop guys and gaffers are pulling me aside to tell me their favorite dirty joke.
Comedy surprises you. Often the surprise comes from a shift of perception and reveals a surprising motivation. It's the twist you never saw coming, but once it arrives, it makes total sense. Like most great jokes, this chapter has a big twist at the end. You'll never guess what happens. Even with me telling you that you'll never guess, you'll still never guess. But when we get there, it will make total sense. Fresh off Wilton North's cancellation, I returned to the East Coast in early 1988, eager to find another TV job. My top choice was Late Night with David Letterman, and I asked my agent about the hiring process. He said I would need to write a submission that included ideas for desk pieces, pieces Dave would do at the desk, and remotes, pieces shot outside the studio. In a couple of weeks, I pulled together enough material for what is today referred to as a packet. The trick was to match Late Night's mischievous tone. I included one gag where Dave gets a song stuck in his head, and throughout the hour, the song intrudes on the show at random times through the set speakers, distracting Dave, the audience, and the guests. Gavin passed the packet along to the show's head writer. A few weeks later, he called with a happy agent, hello. My Letterman material had gotten me a meeting. Just not with Letterman. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, a relaunch of the once popular primetime 60s variety series, was looking for writers. Gavin had given my material to producer and former Dick Van Dyke Show writer, Ernie Chambers. Ernie was in New York City for one day and wanted to meet me. Could I have breakfast with him the next morning? Yes. And did I know the Smothers Brothers? Are you kidding? Actually, I barely knew them at all. The Smothers Brothers' original show aired from 1967 to 1969, and I wasn't that into political humor at age 7. I knew the brothers were named Tom and Dick, and that one played the bass and the other the guitar, but I couldn't have told you which played which. Today, Google would have gotten me up to speed, but Sergey Brin and Larry Page were still in high school. I ran to the only place where you could watch old television episodes, a museum. Sitting in a cubicle at the Midtown Museum of Broadcasting and Radio, I watched 3 episodes of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, laughing loudly enough to disturb others. Dick played the bass and the straight man. Tom played the guitar and the fool. The template for these sketches was ingenious. The brothers would start singing a song until Tom interrupted. Dick would react annoyed as Tom launched into a bit about something topical. That bit would build to a punchline, and then the brothers would return to the song. So often comedy sketches don't know how to end, so going back to a catchy song created a natural and satisfying finish. Tom and Dick started their careers as clean-cut, all-American folk singers, and their variety series was promoted as a hip alternative to the Ed Sullivan Show. The show's tone changed as the country grew divided in the late 60s. Tom started to give airtime to radical voices who opposed the Vietnam War and promoted civil rights. Despite network warnings, the Smothers Brothers remained political, openly promoting peace. In the second season, the brothers committed an even worse sin. They grew facial hair. By the third season, sponsors complained, and in April 1969,
CBS abruptly pulled the plug. Months later, the writing staff, which included Steve Martin, Lorenzo, Carlton the doorman, music, Mason, classical gas, Williams, and Carl, Jaws, Gottlieb, won an Emmy for outstanding writing achievement in comedy, variety, or music. Slowly, the country evolved toward Tom's way of thinking. Watergate took down Nixon, and everyone now agrees that the Vietnam War was a colossal clusterfuck. 2 decades after the original series was canceled, CBS invited the Smothers Brothers back for an hour-long special. The old writing staff returned and ratings soared. Variety shows had been declared dead, but CBS sensed a faint pulse. The network ordered 5 additional episodes. The only problem was that the program couldn't secure the all-star writing staff beyond the reunion. That's where I came in. I headed to my breakfast meeting with Ernie, and immediately a slight misunderstanding arose. Based on my material, Ernie thought I was currently on staff at Letterman. I had to explain that he had read my submission, but I had never worked there. It was awkward, but it secretly pleased me that someone thought my pitches sounded like they could have aired on Letterman. Ernie kept an open mind and hired me. 2 weeks later, I was flying to L.A. for a few months of work. I had no plan on where to sleep or how to get around. I was 27 and didn't care about logistics. Besides, a rental car could solve both problems. My first night in L.A., I joined my new boss for dinner. Tom Smothers plays an idiot on TV, but in real life he's brilliant, thoughtful, and unpretentious. We talked about comedy partnerships and his admiration for Laurel and Hardy. At the end of the dinner, Tom asked where I was staying. "At a hotel for the moment," I said. "I'm still trying to figure it out." "If you want, you could stay with me," he said. "CBS rented me a huge place. There's a maid's room you could sleep in." Tom described the West Hollywood apartment, a stately brick building just down the road from the Chateau Marmont, huge living room, big fireplace. Movie stars Clark Gable and Myrna Loy once resided there. Betty Davis and Christopher Guest still did. "And we could drive to work together," Tom added. I was taken aback. How do you respond to an offer like that? Apparently, you say yes. It was probably inappropriate for me to move in with my boss. Still, it made some sense. I was the help, so why not live in the maid's room? I didn't worry about Tom crossing any lines. He was famous. He had hung out with the coolest people on the planet and smoked pot with Harry Nilsson and John Lennon. He had hot tubbed with Tuesday Weld. He was 20 years older than me. Okay, I was new to Hollywood. My first night in the maid's room, I was in bed wearing just a T-shirt and reading a book when I heard a knock on my door. "Nell, you still up?" My heart started beating faster. Maybe I'd been wrong and the situation was about to get uncomfortable. I pulled on pants and opened the door. Tom was holding a book. "I wanted you to have this," he said. He handed me a copy of Shadow Dancing in the USA, a book of essays by journalist Michael Ventura. Tom said goodnight and walked away. A twist! I slipped back into bed and flipped open the cover. Tom had inscribed the first page with a simple message. "I hope you enjoy the book." Tom turned out to be a superb roommate. Each morning we'd drive to the office in his white Mercedes and talk about books and politics. The commute became my favorite part of the day. The only time that's ever been true for me in L.A. Maybe the only time that's ever been true for anyone in L.A. The first day of work, I met the rest of the writing staff who all had 20 years on me. Head writer Mason Williams was soft-spoken and cerebral, apt to quote George Bernard Shaw. He was openly disdainful of Hollywood, and yet he had 3 Grammys and an Emmy. Mason didn't like showbiz, but showbiz sure liked Mason. The room also included Jim Stafford, a novelty singer who'd scored a hit in the mid-70s with a song co-written with David Bellamy. "Spiders and Snakes" made it to number 3 on the charts when I was 14.
The premise was a boy and girl go for a walk, and he keeps harassing her by shaking frogs in her face and looking for critters to drop down her shirt. She, however, is interested in a more mature relationship and informs him, "I don't like spiders and snakes." Stafford parlayed his folksy appeal and boyish good looks into a summer variety replacement series in 1976. It didn't last long, nor did his 1978 marriage to country music legend Bobby Gentry, who wrote and sang the mega-hit Ode to Billy Joe. Gentry's song relates the gothic tale of a Mississippi teenage couple spotted throwing something mysterious off a bridge. The lyrics never make clear what the couple tossed, or why Billy Joe McAllister went back later and jumped into the murky waters himself. The reason for his suicide was a pop culture riddle, and when someone asked Stafford about living with his famous ex-wife, he archly replied, "Let's just say, I know why Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge." It was a great joke. Unfortunately, Stafford's dim view of women extended beyond ex-wives. He preferred hanging with the guys, smoking cigarettes, and playing guitar. As far as he was concerned, I didn't belong. To a certain extent, he was right. If you were singing, "One of these things is not like the others," I was the obvious answer. I was also the only one who was young enough to have grown up on Sesame Street and get that reference. At Spy and Wilton North, our humor was snarky and nothing was sacred. One day at Smothers, we were headed to the stage when someone brought up the late Mamas and Papas lead singer Mama Cass Elliott. The rumor at the time, now debunked, was that Mama Cass had choked to death on a ham sandwich. I was walking behind Tom and made some wisecrack like, "She should have had the soup." Tom wheeled around with a stern look. "Cass was amazing," he scolded me, "and I loved her." Tom's reprimand has stayed with me ever since. I felt so mean and small. He was right to scold and remind me that an important rule of comedy is, know your audience. I should have known they were friends. Truly, one of the sweetest clips on the internet is Mama Cass singing "Dream a Little Dream of Me" to a sleepy Tom in 1968. I apologized at the time, but the moment still eats at me, much like, Nell, don't. Each week, the five writers had to generate a cold open, two musical bits for the brothers, and intros for their guests. I got assigned a lot of intros, which often meant meeting the artists. Once, Tom sent me to interview singer-songwriter John Hartford, who wrote "Gentle on My Mind," the only song I ever learned to play on the guitar. John turned down a dressing room, preferring to relax in his tour bus that was parked in the studio lot. When I boarded, half a dozen card-playing band members whipped their heads in my direction. "Hi," I said. "Tom wanted me to talk to John." Without a word, the band members threw down their cards and hustled off the bus. It struck me as odd until someone later explained that one of the rules of the road is when a lady gets on the bus looking for the boss, the crew disappears. Fast. Intros tended to be more clever than funny, and I was desperate to come up with a solid bit for Tom and Dick. I sat in my tiny office and churned out sketches. In one, I had Tom tell Dick that he had an idea for a movie. Dick asks, "What kind?" Tom, "It's a love triangle." Dick, "A love triangle sounds good. Who'd be in it?" Tom, "You and me." Dick, "You and me and..." Tom, "A triangle." In a sketch designed to lead into "I Can't Help Falling in Love with You," I had Tom confess to Dick that he's dating a much younger woman. Dick, to audience, "Now I know what you're thinking, and I disagree. I think it's fine that my brother's going out with someone his junior." Tom, "She's a senior. Marshall High School." Tom kind of liked that last one and personally edited it, penciling notes in his neat cursive. Tom's comments include a lot of "not right yet," and "this gives the wrong impression." It was hard to capture the brothers' complicated onstage relationship and make Tom just the right shade of stupid. It was also important that the bits be socially relevant. Sketch after sketch of mine fell short. For the second episode, the brothers were looking for a bit to pair with the song Give Me That Old-Time Religion. I started working on an idea about Cain and Abel. They were brothers just like us, Dick would say, only they got along better. I filled out the sketch. Tom liked the broad strokes as well as the final punchline. He and Mason did a pass, and Cain and Abel went into the script. Even more amazing, it stayed in. Standing in the wings during the taping, I felt like Steve Martin in The Jerk when he sees his name in the phone book. Tom and Dick launched into the song, then Tom interrupted to talk about his favorite Bible stories like Joseph and his coat of many collars. The jokes were landing. The audience was laughing. As the bit neared the end, Tom went off script. He often ad-libbed to make his performance edgier, which was fine so long as he landed on, "And that's why Abel was killed." He needed to use that exact wording to properly set up Dick's final zinger. But Tom wasn't going near the line. Dick tried to prompt him. Tom kept spinning. The energy in the room dipped and my grin dropped. Tom had forgotten what he needed to say. I started to panic. Then suddenly, he pivoted. "And that's why Abel was killed," Tom said. "No," Dick responded. "Abel was killed for interrupting his brother." The audience roared as the brothers launched back into singing, "Give Me That Old-Time Religion." People applauded at the end. My heart swelled. When Tom came off stage, he spotted me in the wings and approached. He leaned in close with a twinkle in his eye. "I had to make Dickie sweat up there," he confided. "A twist!" Tom hadn't forgotten the line. He knew exactly what he was doing. And in that moment, I realized it wasn't just Dick. We all play straight man to Tom Smothers. Around the third and fourth episode, the mood shifted at work. We'd burned through the material we stockpiled during pre-production and no longer had time to hone new sketches. Tom and my carpooling days were over. Before production started, I'd moved out of his maid's room and onto the couch of Marcy Carricker, the show's associate producer. Marcy and I were both short, brunette, and in our 20s, and she became the life preserver that kept me from drowning in a sea of middle-aged men. A bond often naturally develops between the female employees on predominantly male shows. Even if the two women are as different as humans can be, there'll be times when they huddle and whisper, "Did that just happen?" At one job, I regularly stopped by another woman's office to ask, "Am I corporeal? You can see and hear me, right?" Marcy was an exceptional roommate, kind, generous, and a remarkable storyteller. Back then, she was obsessed with true crime and would recount the horrific details of her favorite homicides. Sometimes a grisly murder-suicide was just the thing to take my mind off the increasingly tense writer's room. Heading into the fourth out of six episodes, the network was still weighing a pickup. Tom was on edge. One way to increase the possibility of more episodes is to make changes in your creative team, which signals to the network that the production is still trying to find the right formula. In a sad twist, Mason was demoted abruptly, and Jim Stafford was elevated to head writer. This made me nervous. Stafford favored sketches that ended with Tom calling his brother a butt brain. He also didn't seem to value or even want my input. The first Friday after the personnel shakeup, Tom sent all the writers off to come up with ideas for a cold open over the weekend. I arrived on Monday morning with a page of pitches. I stopped by Stafford's office to hand them in. "Thanks, Nell," he said. "But you know, some of the boys and I got together by the pool yesterday and we worked it all out." My fears were coming true. You can't succeed when you're not even allowed to participate. As Stafford got more powerful, he got bolder. Guitar great Chet Atkins was booked on the show, and I walked from the offices to the stage to sit in the empty audience and watch him rehearse. Stafford was waiting to rehearse, too. He was now appearing on every episode and sat next to me. We listened as Atkins sang a gorgeous tribute to his deceased father. When the song ended, I gushed about Atkins, which gave Stafford an idea. "If you like him, Nell, here's what you should do," he said. Then he suggested that I go offer Atkins a blowjob. This comment came out of nowhere. One second my mind was on Atkins singing about his father and death, and the next, Stafford was suggesting something you don't associate with either of those. A twist! I decided it was best to treat this as a joke and laughed. Every woman knows that forced. Still, something about Stafford's comment threw me. It wasn't the crudeness. Maybe it was the setting. Stafford and I were isolated, and that made the moment creepy. Coincidentally, a photographer was on the set the same day and asked to snap our photo. The result captured our dynamic for all of time. Stafford tossed his arm around my shoulders and leaned his head against mine, invading my space. I reacted politely to his overfamiliarity, as women in the workplace are expected to do, but my smile is not my usual toothy grin. It's tight-lipped and restrained. My body is curled up in a ball, and my right hand is visibly clenched. The sense of desperation was mounting as we started our final week of production. Would this episode be the last? Finally, word came in. CBS wanted 6 more episodes. We all cheered, although my status was unclear. My contract was only for the initial order, and now Stafford was in charge. I asked my agent to see where I stood. Stafford told Gavin that no decisions had been made on the writers. He'd be figuring it out over the break. I would have been more freaked out by the uncertainty, except something distracted me. The day before we taped our last episode, another writer pitched a last-minute cold open that parodied a recent spate of tell-all memoirs. The bit involved 3 Smothers employees stepping forward to hawk their books. The parts were cast at the last minute. Tom cast Ken Cragen, his actual manager, to play his fake manager. He hired Steve Martin's old roommate, Gary Mule Deer, to play a gossipy beekeeper. The third employee was described in the script like this. Nell, dressed as a French maid, enters and stands beside Ken. She also carries a book. It was part of the show's DNA to have writers double as performers, so when Tom asked me to pitch in, I was pleased. Still, the costume gave me pause. After months of wearing baggy jeans and Agnes B. striped shirts, I now had to dress like a 50s sexual fantasy. Also, I'd been sitting on my butt for 2 months eating junk food and was worried my thighs weren't exactly camera-ready. The costumer fitted me that morning and, hours later, I wriggled into fishnet stockings, patent leather pumps, an off-the-shoulder black bodice, and a short black skirt with stiff crinoline. A stylist piled my hair in an updo and stuck on a stupid doily hat. Fake eyelashes, lipstick, hey, voila! My writer's room colleagues approved of the look. Now that's more like it, one said. I didn't get terribly nervous because my one line was spoken in unison with Gary and Ken, so there was little to screw up. The bit was over in a flash. The director shot us from the waist up, so the fishnets and skirt were completely unnecessary. I was back in my civvies before Harry Belafonte sang the season's last number. The wrap party was held on stage. I didn't know whether I was saying goodbye to people for a month or forever. As it turned out, I had one more chance to see some of the writers when Stafford decided to throw a small pool party that weekend. Part of me wanted to skip seeing the pool where he and the boys worked, but I worried that if I didn't stop by, it would look like I didn't want to be a member of the team. I came up with the perfect solution. I'd arrive late and take off early. It was getting toward evening when I stopped by. The crowd was thin. No Marcy, no Tom, no Mason. Stafford greeted me enthusiastically. I tried to be as cheerful as possible, last impressions and all that. I made small talk with some guests, and then, per my plan, Would you look at the time?
I found my host to say thanks.
I'll walk you out, Stafford said.
We were passing through his house to the front door when he offered to show me around. The last stop was his bedroom. He ushered me in, shut the door, and immediately started kissing me up against the wall. It was so weird. Why was he kissing me, and even weirder, why wasn't I pulling back? My brain was churning, but my body seemed frozen in shock. For weeks, I'd been so desperate to get Stafford's approval.
Huh, I was getting it now.
But what did it mean? Had I been wrong? Did he actually like me? You don't kiss someone unless you like them, right? Maybe that's why I wasn't pulling back. If making out meant he liked me, I didn't want to do anything to make him not like me. He held my future in his hands. And then, oh my God. He started maneuvering us to the bed. We fell on top of his covers, fully clothed, and continued making out. At one point, I ran my fingers through his hair.
Careful, he snapped. I have a piece.
I peered closer and saw a thin, molded piece of plastic glued to the front of his scalp with fake hair coming out. I'd never noticed it before.
Wow, I thought. That's a good piece.
But before I could contemplate his hair further, Stafford made his next move. He unzipped his pants and used his hand to guide my head down.
This is so, so hard to admit, but, reader, I blew him.
A twist.
You didn't see that coming, did you?
I sure as hell didn't.
And then it was over.
One and done.
The entire incident took less than 10 minutes.
There was no reciprocity. My clothes never came off. He had a party to get back to, and I had to be, you know, anywhere else on the planet.
Racing to my car, I thought, what an interesting turn of events just happened to someone who looks a lot like me.
Reality rushed back in before I made it home. I knew what had happened, and my heart sank. During the act, I had felt a false sense of pride that so many women feel, that smug feeling that Stafford wanted something from me, which meant I was the one in control.